Ted was very friendly. It's like he wanted to stop, but he couldn't, but he knew there was something in him.
That's the voice of Dr. Al Carlisle. In 1976, he was the prison psychologist assigned to evaluate Ted Bundy. Not after the crimes were known, but while they were still happening. What Carlisle was looking at wasn't history, it was a threat that hadn't finished revealing itself.
Ted Bundy is a very disturbed, intelligent person.
Police say two more young women are missing tonight. Investigators are now reviewing whether the cases may be connected.
How can you have such an urge, a habit, a set of behaviors to kill someone?
Ted Bundy's crimes have been studied exhaustively, but what's often missed is how this man came to be. The question isn't what he did, it's when he crossed the line, and whether that line was already far behind him long before anyone realized he was dangerous.
When does it get to a point you've crossed over the line that you can't cross back again? That's the part I like to understand.
I'm James Buddy Day. This is Unmarked.
I remember he walked toward me in the hall, and I was standing outside the room we're going to use for the interview. And as he walked toward me, smile on his face, brisk walk, stuck out his hand and shook mine, says, "Dr. Carlisle, right? I'm Ted Bundy."
Before anyone recognized Ted Bundy, he was arrested in Utah in 1975 during a routine traffic stop. The subsequent investigation identified Bundy as a suspect in numerous unsolved homicides and the attempted kidnapping of a young woman. When that case went to trial, Bundy was convicted, and what came next was critical. Before sentencing and placement, Bundy was ordered to undergo a psychological evaluation. The task fell to prison psychologist Dr. Al Carlisle.
I thought, he's got a nice personality, but what's he going to be like as we start really getting in the nitty-gritty of all of this?
Dr. Carlisle passed away in 2018. The interview you're hearing today was recorded shortly before his death, one of the last he ever gave. When he met Bundy in 1976, Carlisle was no stranger to dangerous offenders. He would go on to spend more than 20 years as a clinical psychologist in the Utah State Prison, eventually retiring in 1989 as the head of the department.
All the time he's with me, he's saying, "I didn't do anything. I'm not guilty of these things they say I might have done up north, and I'm not guilty of Carol Durant. I just didn't do that. I didn't do any of that."
Before we go any deeper, a brief step back. Ted Bundy is often described as one of the most prolific serial killers in American history. And you should know, the full scope of his crimes remain unclear and will likely continue to be the subject of research and debate for years to come. To date, approximately only 20 of his victims have officially been confirmed. And nearly all of those murders occurred within a remarkably compressed period, roughly 4 years between 1974 and 1978. Though Bundy himself claimed responsibility for at least a dozen additional killings. But this episode isn't about how many people Ted Bundy killed. It's about how someone like this comes into existence.
Here you got a guy who's come down to Salt Lake. He's in law school. He has a political career ahead of him.
When Al Carlisle and Ted Bundy sit down together, it's 1976, right in the middle of Bundy's most well-documented killing spree. At the time, Bundy is 30 years old. You have to picture Ted Bundy as he appeared then, a perennial college student, studying law, loosely involved in politics, presenting himself as someone hovering just on the edge of a respectable future.
So here he is, and he has the possibility of losing his whole career And I said, Ted, you don't have any anxiety? None? Or depression? You know, and he says, no, things just don't bother me. I thought, there's something wrong here.
He's thin, tall, often smiling, bright blue eyes that hold contact just a beat longer than necessary. The kind of man who seems eager to help. Nothing about him signals danger.
I gave him some tests in the beginning. Personality, IQ tests and such. His IQ was in the mid-120s, so he's got superior IQ. And by his vocabulary, I knew he was very intelligent. On some of the other tests that measure anxiety, depression, they came out extremely low.
Bundy's high intelligence is unmoored from conscience. He doesn't internalize social or moral constraints. Rules are external obstacles, not internal guidelines. Ethics are something that other people believe in. What Dr. Carlisle sees is a psychopath presenting with such grandiosity that he can't meaningfully imagine the inner lives of other people. Their experiences, their fear, their suffering, none of it registers to Bundy as real.
I talked to people he knew, girlfriends, friends, a few people in Salt Lake who knew him. And they're all impressed with him, except there was another side of the story that some got into. There's one side that most people see when he wants them to, the side he wants to show. And then there's a dark side of him. And so I wanted to get to know the dark side.
For Bundy, the dark side emerges as a young child. He's born in 1946 to Eleanor Louise Cowell at the Elizabeth Lund Home for Unwed Mothers. Shortly after, Bundy is briefly abandoned by his mother. He's taken to Philadelphia, where he's raised by his maternal grandparents. For much of his early childhood, Bundy is led to believe that his mother is his sister, and that his grandparents are his parents. The truth about his parentage is concealed from him, part of a family structure built on secrecy and misdirection.
Back in those days, illegitimacy was a huge thing. And to Ted, he not only the oldest of a family he doesn't fit in, he's very shy.
The term illegitimate, it sounds outdated now, but in the early 1950s, it carried real weight. It meant a child born outside of marriage, at a time when that distinction wasn't just social, but moral. It's hard to imagine now, but it could affect how a family was viewed, where they could live, even how a child was treated in school or church. As a teenager, Bundy is told the truth about his parentage by a cousin. Later in life, Bundy would openly scoff at anyone who suggested that this revelation had any bearing on the man he became.
Now, when I asked Ted about this, he says, oh, that wasn't a big issue. But it really was.
But that dismissal misses a larger point, one that often gets overlooked. Bundy's childhood isn't just marked by secrecy, it's unstable. His grandfather is a brutal disciplinarian. His birth mother moves through a series of relationships. At one point, Bundy is taken by his birth mother to live with an uncle, adding another rupture to an already fragile sense of home. You have to imagine this child early on, isolated, lonely, and acutely aware of what he lacked. He envies the financial security and the emotional stability of the families around him. And that's when something important begins to take shape.
He lived in a place where he could look out his window and down into the window of the next house and see whatever he could see there. And he went out and started window peeking and such. So he began this other life then.
For Ted Bundy, this early behavior later escalates into stalking, but at the time, it's a coping mechanism. Bundy is born with a mind that fixates inward. Add to this that his early environment is unstable, marked by secrecy and emotional distance. Bundy is never given a truthful account of who his father was. And that absence creates a vacuum, one filled with shame, grievance, and envy of those who seem grounded.
Ted, to the other kids, and I talked to a couple of them who were in his neighborhood, they said, well, he wasn't really angry. He was just there, just Ted. He just seemed okay. He didn't stand out in any way. But he got into this fantasy, and he was very lonely.
Watching others lets Bundy study the life that was denied to him. In that space, he begins constructing a private fantasy. And in that fantasy, Bundy would become the man his non-existent father never was. Successful, respected, and powerful.
I said, Ted, what were you after this time in your life? He said, I wanted a beautiful co-ed, and I wanted a profession.
By middle school, Ted Bundy's inner fantasy life only deepens. His emerging psychopathic personality means social cues like discomfort, rejection, or indifference, they don't register the way they do for other children. At this stage, he hasn't yet developed the charm or the mimicry that will later allow him to conceal himself.
I think people stayed away from him, not because they didn't like him or that he was so unusual or that he was violent. They didn't like him because he was so shy and he really didn't speak up and talk, and he didn't seem to want to put himself in social situations.
And that solitude doesn't interrupt the fantasy that's forming inside him. It feeds it. With fewer real relationships to correct or challenge his perceptions, Bundy's internal world grows more elaborate, more insulated, and more detached from what other people see.
I asked him one time, because when he was in junior high, I said, Ted, did you date? Have any girlfriends? Yeah, he said, I have two or three girlfriends. Okay, did you do anything with him? Yeah. Mm-hmm. Did you kiss him? Yeah. Uh-huh.
The people who were there tell a different story. Over the years, family members, classmates, acquaintances, they've all spoken in numerous forums, and their accounts are strikingly consistent. They describe an introverted, withdrawn child, sad and lonely, unable to form attachments, and confused about why he couldn't. At some point, that isolation, fantasy, and grievance coalesce into violence. What we don't know, what we may never know, is exactly when the line was crossed.
He was about 14, and there was this little girl named Anne. She was 8 years old, and she was on his paper route. And he delivered papers over there, and so he likely knew her. And one day she went missing.
In the early morning hours of August 31st, 1961, 8-year-old Anne Marie Burr is abducted from her home. At approximately 5:15 a.m., her mother checks on the four sleeping children. Anne Marie's bed is empty. Downstairs, the signs are unmistakable. The living room window, normally kept cracked open, is wide open. The latch on the front door is undone. Anne Marie Burr is gone.
Whoever it was talked her out of the house, so she knew the person.
Her disappearance triggers a massive search effort and intense media coverage. Police recover a shoe print near the home and theorize that the abductor may be a teenager. No suspect is ever charged. Anne Marie Burr is never found. The Burr home is 6 blocks from where Ted Bundy lives at the time.
I asked Ted, I said, oh, what did you think about that? And he said, I really didn't pay any attention to it. I don't think I really knew about it. And I said, how could you not know about it when everybody's talking about this over breakfast? He says, well, I think I must have just been involved in school, and that was my main interest. You know, and that's when the red flags that go up. You think, whoops, wait a minute. caught him off guard. I think he killed her.
Al Carlisle is not alone in that belief. Years later, while filming a documentary in Tacoma, I spent time with the investigators from the Tacoma Police Department. Off camera, in candid conversations about the case, the view was consistent. They share the opinion that Ted Bundy was solely responsible. Now, that assessment isn't presented as a formal finding, and it isn't a closed case declaration. It's the kind of conclusion investigators arrive at after decades of hindsight. But the truth remains elusive.
All the way through high school, he was very, very lonely, very shy. He couldn't ask a girl for a date. He went to a dance, high school dance, but that didn't amount to anything. But a couple of guys asked him to go skiing. He had got a book on skiing, and he had learned to ski. And so he went skiing with them, and when he was up on the slopes, he was one of the guys. And this was a big turning point, because now he was it. He was in. He was one of them.
For the first time in his life, Bundy discovers something that works. Skiing gives him a way in. It teaches him how to blend, how to mirror confidence, competence, ease. On the slopes, social rules are simple. Skill equals status. Silence reads as focus instead of awkwardness. For Bundy, it's not only a revelation, it introduces him to Taylor Mountain. Taylor Mountain is a rugged, wooded area that's largely undeveloped. Imagine dense forest cut by logging roads and informal trails. It's close enough to town to be accessible, but isolated enough to disappear into. Later, it becomes something else entirely.
Ted graduated high school. He went to University of Puget Sound for a year. He got a scholarship there.
It's now 1966, and Bundy is developing the camouflage he'll use to hide his psychopathy. A college student. If you listened to our episode on the Grim Sleeper, you've already heard me talk about geographic profiling. The idea is simple. Offenders choose locations they know, the corners they watch, the places where they feel invisible. Victim encounters, attack sites, disposal points, they all cluster inside that small comfort zone. Research consistently shows that most serial killers operate close to home. In one major study of 54 serial offenders, 87% of crime scenes fell within a 5-mile radius of the killer's residence. Ted Bundy follows this pattern precisely. He grows up in the University District. He understands these neighborhoods. He knows how to move through college campuses without drawing attention. He knows the rhythms, the class schedules, study halls, late nights, unlocked doors. Campuses offer exactly what Bundy needs: social trust and young people accustomed to strangers. And this camouflage doesn't just facilitate violence, it facilitates connection. While skiing, Bundy meets a fellow student named Diane Marjorie Jean Edwards.
He wanted a politician's wife. He wanted someone who was beautiful, and she was. He wanted someone who was intelligent, and she was. You know, her father was the CEO of an international company, and so they were quite wealthy, you know, and Ted was very poor. He falls head over heels in love with her. And she is the major turning point in his whole life.
While his first serious girlfriend continues her studies at the University of Washington, Bundy begins to move freely between institutions. He transfers from the University of Puget Sound to the University of Washington and later spends time taking classes through Stanford University, including a brief summer session.
He went to Stanford for the summer, and he took classes in Chinese studies, and he really liked it. Boy, he was in his element then.
New campuses mean new faces, new routines, and no long-term accountability. At the same time, something darker is unfolding. Bundy begins to follow female students. He breaks into dormitories, and these intrusions aren't random. They're exploratory. Rehearsals. This is where he finds exhilaration. By this point, it's almost certain that Bundy is already hurting people, though the specifics of when and how remain poorly understood even to this day. His movements during these years are fragmented, difficult to reconstruct, and largely self-reported.
There was one time that he had molested a woman, possibly killed her, and he was driving away, and he was crying because he felt so bad about what the direction his life was going, you know. And he rolled down the window and started throwing some of her things out. And it seems like he didn't really understand why he did. And which may sound rather ridiculous.
By 1969, Ted Bundy is 22 years old, moving constantly, drifting between campuses, cities, and states. He's exploring universities the way other people explore neighborhoods. By his own admission, Bundy is passing through New Jersey over Memorial Day weekend of 1969. 1 week later, on Monday, June 2nd, 1969, the bodies of two young women are discovered hidden beneath piles of leaves in dense woods near Summers Point, about 200 yards from the Garden State Parkway and roughly 150 yards from their abandoned car.
Memorial Day, 1969. He was going to drive a car back, he told me, back west. And he was out to New Jersey Beach, and there were two girls out there. And he somehow got them to ride with him. He killed them both, you know. And I think that was a huge turning point.
What matters here is the shift. The medical examiner later concludes that Susan Davis and Elizabeth Perry, both 19 years old, had been killed by stabbing several days earlier. The two women had been staying in Ocean City on vacation since the previous Tuesday. They were last seen leaving a diner together days before their bodies were discovered. But by this point, Bundy is fully engrossed in his fantasy world, at the expense of the only real relationship he's ever managed to achieve.
Marjorie was up at the UW finishing out some classes. And she began cutting off the relationship little by little. Then finally she said to him, you know, I'm sorry, Ted, I'm not ready for a real serious relationship. Let's just be friends. And he, you know, that was it. That was his whole world was absolutely destroyed at that point.
Moving between campuses and cities gives him temporary trust and anonymity, but it also demands something that he can't sustain. His grades begin to slip. At one point, he's forced to drop out.
Now, he's applied to law schools, and University of Utah was one of them. He applied to six of them, and he got turned down by five. And he took the LSAT, failed it twice. It was about 2 days after that you have the first attempted homicide.
On January 4th, 1974, Bundy targets a young woman who embodies what he feels he's lost, a female student attending the University of Washington. He breaks into an apartment in the University District of Seattle where he assaults a sleeping student named Karen Sparks. Miraculously, she survives, though with lifelong disabilities. The geography here matters. Sparks' apartment is roughly 1 mile from the University of Washington, close enough to sit firmly inside Bundy's comfort zone. It's an area he knows intimately, an area where he still presents himself as a student, even though in reality that identity is fractured.
there's a feeling of possession. And so that's what he was after.
That word, possession, that's key. By this point, Ted Bundy isn't seeking connection. He isn't even seeking validation. What he wants is ownership, control. Within weeks, the violence becomes unmistakable. On February 1st, Bundy abducts 22-year-old Linda Ann Healy from her basement bedroom near the University of Washington. On March 12th, he kidnaps Donna Gail Manson, 19 years old, as she walks to a concert at Evergreen State College. A month later, on April 17th, Bundy lures Susan Elaine Rancourt, 18, from a meeting at Central Washington State College. On May 6th, he abducts Roberta Kathleen Parks, 22, from Oregon State University. And on June 1st, Brenda Carol Ball, 22, disappears after leaving the Flame Tavern in Buren.
Ted's killing these people. And I think at that point, he can't stop. He's crossed the line. He's so addicted. I don't think he likes what he's doing, but he can't stop.
The pattern is crystal clear, even if some of the details are not. We don't know precisely what ruse Bundy used in every case, but in some instances, witnesses report seeing him speaking with the women, often wearing a sling on his arm, sometimes asking for help. It's a performance designed to lower defenses, to appear harmless, to invite proximity.
He goes into another and another and another and another, and each one of these, you can see they're well planned. He has a lot of confidence in what he's doing.
What forensic evidence later establishes is consistent. In each case, Bundy incapacitates the victim inside his vehicle, then transports them to Taylor Mountain, the remote wooded area he knows so well. A short drive from where he often goes skiing.
He would go back to Taylor Mountain, you know, when he lived up there, and visit the corpses.
By the summer of 1974, Ted Bundy's violence escalates. On June 11th, Bundy abducts Georgia Ann Hawkins, 18 years old, from the alley behind her sorority house near the University of Washington. This time, the geography changes. Bundy transports Hawkins east to the Issaquah area into the forested foothills of the Cascades. It's wooded and remote, but it's not his original corridor. This isn't Taylor Mountain. This is outside his comfort zone. And that shift matters. It signals confidence, a willingness to travel farther, to manage greater risk, to operate beyond the spaces that he knows best. The fantasy is no longer contained. It's expanding.
In the summer of 74, two girls went missing at Lake Sammamish.
On July 14th, 1974, Ted Bundy is seen by dozens of people approaching young women at Lake Sammamish. Lake Sammamish is a sprawling state park east of Seattle, a summer gathering place with beaches, picnic areas, boat launches, and long sight lines. On warm weekends, it's crowded and loud, a place defined by visibility. That day, the park is packed. There are more than 40,000 people there, families, students, couples, friends. It's the opposite of isolation. Early in the day, Bundy begins approaching young women in plain view of everyone around them. He introduces himself casually. His arm is in a sling. He asks for help unloading a sailboat.
She went up to the parking lot with him. It wasn't there. The car was there. The boat wasn't. He says, "Oh, it's up in this little town." She says, "I'm sorry, I've got someone coming. I can't help you." She went back.
By this point, Ted Bundy has become so detached from other people that he believes he's effectively invisible. When an eyewitness later describes him, he's reportedly shocked. Despite committing these crimes in front of more than 40,000 people and using his real name, that matters. Bundy no longer feels the need to protect himself. When his first approach fails, when one potential target escapes, Bundy doesn't even retreat. He escalates. In broad daylight, he abducts Janice Ann Ott, 23 years old. She's last seen leaving Lake Sammamish with Bundy.
He went back to virtually the same spot, close enough for her to hear, and said to another girl, "Hi, my name is Ted. Could you help me?" And she went to help him, and she disappeared. And that's how they came up with the name Ted.
4 hours later, he returns to the exact same spot, and he does it again. This time, he abducts Denise Marie Naslin, 19. Two abductions, same day, same location, same ruse.
In Lake Sammamish, he kidnapped the one, and then molested and killed her. Then he kidnapped the other.
Bundy transports both women east, into the forests near Issaquah. But in the weeks after Lake Sammamish, something shifts. Witnesses are talking, and investigators are converging. So Bundy does what he's done his entire adult life. He transfers to another school. Bundy leaves Washington and enrolls at the University of Utah College of Law. The move accomplishes several things at once. First, it puts physical distance between him and active investigations. It places him under a new institutional identity, a law student. He's ambitious and respectable once again. And second, it shifts him into an entirely different jurisdiction where no one is looking at him.
Ted came down here to go to school, the University of Utah, the law school. And they sent a communique from up in Washington down and says, "Hey, you've got a Ted Bundy down there that could possibly be a suspect in these." And there's a bunch of girls had been disappearing.
In Oregon and Utah, Ted Bundy continues. On October 1st, he abducts Nancy Wilcox, 16 years old, from a shopping mall in Oregon. 17 days later, October 18th, Bundy intercepts Melissa Ann Smith, 17, outside a pizza parlor as she's walking home. On October 31st, Halloween night, he kidnaps Laura and Amy, also 17, as she heads home from a party. The pace is shocking. The victims are younger. The confidence is growing. A week later, on November 8th, Bundy crosses another line. Outside a shopping mall in Utah, he poses as a police officer and targets Carol Durange, 18.
He comes up and he identifies himself as a police officer from the Murray station. And he says, "I think someone broke into your car. Do you have a Camaro?" "Yeah, I think someone broke into your car. Can you come and see if there's anything missing?" "Nothing's missing." He says, "Well, let's drive over to the police station." He pulls out these handcuffs and he starts slapping on her.
She manages to escape, jumping from Bundy's vehicle after he mistakenly fastens a pair of handcuffs to the same wrist. It's a critical failure. A rare break in his control, but Bundy doesn't stop. Shortly afterward, he drives to a nearby middle school and abducts Deborah Jean Kent, 17, from the parking lot.
I had another killer tell me, he says, "When you're all worked up to do this type of thing and it doesn't go through," he says, you can't back off. You can't settle down. You can't let it go until you've done it.
The victims are all left in wooded or remote areas. The methods are consistent. There's no serious question about who is responsible. But with each homicide, Bundy feels more invincible, confident that no one can stop him. By 1975, he's moving constantly through Utah, Colorado, Idaho, leaving a widening trail of violence behind him. On January 12, 1975, Bundy lures Karen Eileen Campbell, 23, from a hotel hallway in Snowmass Village, abducting her from the parking lot. Her body is later recovered a month later near a dirt road. On March 15th, he takes Julie Lyle Cunningham, 26, while she's walking from her apartment to a local pub. Less than a month later, on April 6th, Bundy stalks Denise Lynn Oliverson, 24, as she cycles towards her parents' home in Grand Junction. Her body is never recovered. On May 6th, he abducts Lynette Don Culver, 12, from an Alameda Junior High School during her lunch break. Then, on June 28th, Bundy abducts Susan Curtis, 15, during a youth conference at Brigham Young University after she leaves her friends to return to her dorm. The geography is expanding. The age range is narrowing. The frequency is accelerating. And still, no arrest. That finally changes in August of 1975. Bundy's first arrest doesn't come from a long investigation or a targeted manhunt. It comes completely by accident. Late one night in Murray, Utah, a patrol officer named Bob Hayward notices a Volkswagen Beetle driving erratically with its headlights off. He pulls the car over for a routine stop.
Ted was off over here with his Volkswagen coming along with his lights off, smoking a joint. And as his Volkswagen is searched, they find an ice pick, they find a ski mask, they find a crowbar, they find some of these other things. And Harvard thinks, well, this looks like burglary tools. So he arrests them.
Bundy gives evasive answers. He's arrested on suspicion of kidnapping. And within days, Carol Duranche identifies Bundy as her attacker. And it's this identification that changes everything. For the first time, investigators across Utah, Washington, and Colorado begin actively sharing information. The fragmented pieces, the witness statements, the vehicle descriptions, the survivor testimony, it all starts to align on one person. After a four-day bench trial and a weekend of deliberation, a judge finds Bundy guilty of kidnapping and assault. With that conviction secured, Bundy is transferred to Colorado to face murder charges for the first time. Now, we could spend an entire episode talking about Ted Bundy's escapes and his legal maneuvering, but the important part is this. On June 7th, 1977, while preparing for trial, Bundy escapes by jumping from a second-story window of the courthouse in Aspen, Colorado. He disappears into the surrounding mountains and remains at large for several days. Then, something unexpected happens. Bundy walks himself back into town and turns himself in. But it's not because he couldn't escape. It's because he was hungry and tired. Remember, Bundy doesn't experience fear or guilt in a way that would drive surrender. What he feels instead is irritation at the inconvenience. The escape stops being rewarding once it becomes physically unpleasant. This is a key feature of psychopathy, short-term dominance over long-term planning.
When he went to Colorado and he escaped and he was caught, then he called me. We talked for about 15 minutes on the phone. And he says, "I just wanted to know what you thought of my escape." You know, just like, almost like someone calling their father and says, "You know, I had a home run. I just want to know what you thought about it." And but very friendly talk. Then he escaped again shortly after that.
The second time, Bundy adapts. On December 30th, 1977, Ted Bundy slips out of the Garfield County Jail, exploiting his own familiarity with the system. This time, he doesn't head into the wilderness. He heads towards something much more familiar.
When he escaped the second time from jail, his objective was to go to South America, start all over again, give up contact with everyone, get himself another profession down there. Where'd he end up? Florida.
After his second escape, before he ever reaches Florida, Ted Bundy puts the camouflage back on. Bundy surfaces in Ann Arbor, where he goes to a college bar and watches the Michigan Wolverines lose to the USC Trojans in the Rose Bowl. This matters. It tells us he isn't panicked, he isn't hiding. In fact, he almost gets in a bar fight while watching the game. He's doing what he's always done, placing himself in student environments where he knows how to blend, where his age and demeanor do not stand out, where no one asks questions. From there, he steals a car. He takes a bus, and eventually he arrives at Florida State University. Once again, he presents himself as a law student, steals another car, and breaks into dormitories. He takes valuables and credit cards.
Ted said at one time, he says, you know, I can be here talking to you, and then I can be gone and you won't find me.
1 week later, Ted Bundy commits the act that finally shatters any remaining illusion of control. Shortly before 3 a.m., Bundy breaks into the Chi Omega sorority house at Florida State University through a rear door. Once inside the house, he moves from room to room. Two young women, Margaret Elizabeth Bowman, 21, and Lisa Janet Levy, 20, are killed in their sleep. Two others, Kathleen Kleiner and Karen Chandler, both 21, are brutally injured but survive. This attack is different from everything that came before. It's loud, it's chaotic, it leaves witnesses. About a month later, on February 8th, Bundy steals a Florida State University van and drives roughly 150 miles east to Jacksonville. In a parking lot, he approaches a 14-year-old girl, falsely identifying himself as a fire department official. The encounter ends abruptly when her older brother intervenes. But that same day, Bundy doubles back to Lake City, and the following morning, at Lake City Junior High School, he poses as a teacher and removes Kimberly Diane Leach, 12 years old, from her homeroom. Her remains are found in a rural area outside the city. This crime marks the final collapse. A week later, Bundy is arrested for the final time. Once again, it's not through a sweeping manhunt, but after being stopped for suspicious driving behavior.
When he got picked up by the police, he wrote a letter and he said, "What's happening to me is like an alcoholic." He says, "I would find myself following girls around campus at night, and I didn't want to do it, but I couldn't not do it. I couldn't stop." You know? So that, just that type, it gets to a point that a person say, okay, how do I stop? Could I stop? Can I ever stop? You know, and if so, what do I have to do?
After his final arrest in Florida in February of 1978, Ted Bundy is tried, convicted, and sentenced to death for multiple murders. His trials are highly publicized and marked by Bundy's insistence on representing himself by repeated attempts to manipulate the court. After years on death row and numerous appeals, Bundy is executed by the electric chair at Florida State Prison on January 24th, 1989. But the takeaway from this man's life is that Ted Bundy didn't emerge fully formed. Psychologically, he was vulnerable early, detached, inward, struggling to regulate shame and envy. That vulnerability was compounded by an unstable childhood marked by secrecy, disruption, and emotional distance. Out of that mix came a recurrent fantasy. Success, admiration, and power, a version of himself that felt untouchable. But fantasy alone isn't dangerous. What changed is that the fantasy attached itself to what he could not have: young women, college students, lives that symbolize status, belonging, and choice. The scary truth is this: Bundy wasn't invisible because he was brilliant. He was invisible because the system wasn't built to see someone like him. And by the time anyone understood what they were looking at, the line Al Carlisle talked about, the one you can't cross back from, was already far behind him.
See, with Ted, it's a feeling that there's a dark side which you've created over time and it gets more and more and more powerful, that there's a competition, so to speak, between the dark side and the good side. Every time they're in it, they're feeling a sense of power.
Before we wrap up, a quick note. If this case pulled you in, if you're interested in the psychology behind someone like Bundy, then my book might interest you. It's called Charles Manson, The Last Words. It goes deep into that world. It's built from years of research and direct interviews with members of the Manson family, including Manson himself. And if you want more beyond the episodes, there's a lot waiting for you inside Unmarked Case Files. It's our research portal where you can go through documents, extended interviews, and the material behind these stories. Now, Unmarked takes a ton of work to produce. Every episode comes out of weeks of research, documents, interviews, and we're starting to work with advertisers to support that work. But if you'd rather listen without ads and get early access to all the episodes, you can join us inside Unmarked Case Files. If you're already there, thank you. It genuinely helps keep this research going. This episode of Unmarked was produced by John Nadeau and edited by Dave Alderson. Our additional producer is Jesse Demaray. Until next week, this is Unmarked.